The following podcast is a Super Network production and spin-off of the King Zone podcast with the King Zone's Book Club podcast, hosted by Super Marcy.
Growing up, I kind of always saw myself as the main character.
And Stephen T. Boltz.
Yeah, no, I do love this book. I really do.
It contains adult themes.
The way that there are these coming-of-age themes when you're on the cusp of becoming a teenager.
Coarse language.
So I would have been one of the crucified ones.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Prepare to take a deep dive into the literary works of Stephen King with us. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the King Zone spin-off podcast with the King Zone's Book Club podcast. This is our debut episode. I am your host, Super Marcy, and joining me for this King literary journey is my co-host and friend, Stephen T. Boltz. Hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm well. Yeah, I'm good.
Very good, very good. We are we're here to talk Stephen King, but in a different way that I do with Bead on the King Zone podcast, because we are going to be mainly focusing on the short stories of Stephen King, and we'll throw in the occasional novella or novel, and I believe we're going to try cover two stories per episode once a month or so, if I'm right.
Yeah, I think that sounds good. That sounds good. And I can talk Stephen King for days, honestly, so this is a perfect platform. I've been waiting for something like this since I was 12, so.
Well, You're welcome, 12-year-old. as we do on the King Zone, it is like a deep dive into the film or TV series adaptations or miniseries. This is a kind of deep dive into the actual stories. We're not going to compare to any adaptations of it. We're just going to focus on the actual story. So it is quite different from the King Zone, and we'll be talking about things that haven't been adapted or, you know, all sorts of things. I'm very excited, I might add.
Yeah, this is going to be good. The short stories don't get enough love. I think people are often, you know, they think of King and they think of the novels, or they think of the short stories that have been adapted to film, often quite liberally, actually. Children of the Corn, for one, you know. So yeah, things like that. Going back and looking at the short stories that don't see as much fandom, I think.
Yeah, I think so. And so I guess we have our own histories with Stephen King. For me, a lot of the short stories we'll be covering I have not read, whereas you have actually read them, so it'll be very interesting, two completely different perspectives on podcast, especially for this one, because I had not read either of the stories.
Oh,
so
wow.
It'll be very interesting.
That's excellent.
Yeah, and I guess we kind of decided to I've actually been planning to do the spin-off podcast for a while, to focus more on the stories or novels or novellas without going into the adaptations themselves, which is a focus of the other podcast. And as we were talking, kind of thought, yeah, okay, let's actually cover some short stories and do this with some, you know, actual frequency, like once a month, to complement, in a way, the other show. So, you know, I can actually have a reason, not that I need a reason, but these days I might need a reason to actually read more Stephen King and discover the short story. So it's a good reading exercise for me, and who better to do it with than someone who knows Stephen King's works very, very well than you. So that is pretty much the basis for this show, to give everybody listening a bit of history and explanation, so you know what you'll be getting into. For our two stories to talk about today, I believe this was your idea, so you can kind of explain your thoughts on, I guess, starting with these two.
Oh, well, look, it started, we were going to do three. We were going to pick three stories from Night Shift. We'd had Trucks was one. Help me out.
I think we had Trucks, maybe Lawnmower Man.
Trucks, Lawnmower Man, and some third thing. I can't remember what it was. As we were discussing it further, I thought it would be fun to read, to discuss the story Weeds, that was filmed in Creepshow as The Lonesome Death of Geordie Barrel. But then I thought, wouldn't it be even more fun to put the Lawnmower Man and weeds together and sort of do a themed show?
Yeah.
So we decided to hold off on the Lawnmower Man, but then the theme idea started percolating. And Jerusalem's Lot and One for the Road are both both stories from Night Shift, from the collection Night Shift, but they both have really strong ties to King's second novel, Salem's Lot. I pitched this idea, thought let's try. Now the themes are going to be pretty strong in the beginning, and I think as we continue, they're going to be a little more tenuous and might not be themed after a little while. But I think this is a good one to start with.
Yes, it got me very excited, and I have not read Salem's Lot, so there's something I do want to actually read. But kind of knowing the story in its basics, in the adaptation.
You know the films, you know them.
Yes, because, and we did cover those for the King Zone. So it's a bit more fresh in my memory. I find Salem's Lot quite a fascinating idea, like King's take on a Dracula kind of thing. And I guess even just knowing that he wrote more based around this, I found very interesting. So when you pitched this, I was like, let's look at Jerusalem's Lot and One for the Road. And these are both, I believe, collected in Night Shift.
Yeah, that's right. Jerusalem's Lot is the first story in the collection. It was actually written when King was in college, but it wasn't published anywhere until 1978 in Night Shift. It did get a reprint later. The illustrated edition of Salem's Lot that came out in 2006, Jerusalem's Lot was published in that, as well as One for the Road. So there's a little Salem's Lot compendium for you if you just want to grab everything at once.
I actually need to own a proper, nice, beautiful copy of Night Shift, which I'll get one day.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, my.
My problem is I have no room to store things, and they just keep piling up.
Yeah, that's the tragedy, isn't it? That's the worst. Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerusalem's Lot is a short story and prequel to Salem's Lot.
I'm going to pull you up there, Marcy.
Yes.
I'm not so sure it's a prequel. Like we've got it, grouped, and obviously Salem's Lot came from this story, but I see it as more like an alternate universe version of Salem's Lot, because it's set in the 1800s. The basis for the Booth family goes back to the 1700s, and there are vampires there already. In Salem's Lot, the vampires show up with Mr. Barlow and Mr. Straker when they come to town. The evil has always been there with Hubie Marston, the bootlegging, the Marston house, and all that sort of stuff. So Salem's Lot has always had a sort of, like, it's possible that it's a prequel, but I don't see the vampires coming in like the 1700s, 1800s, then fucking off to parts unknown, waiting for Hubie Marston to come in, and then Mr. Barlow. It's an interesting story, but I think more than a prequel, it's like a springboard to Salem's Lot, right? Like, it started the idea, and then he just spun it out to this, Jerusalem's Lot is very much an H.P. Lovecraft story.
Yes.
Very much. The it draws from a couple of different stories jumped out at me. The Rats in the Walls, obviously, was a big one. The Haunter of the Dark, and the idea of blood calling to blood is The Shadow over Innsmouth, right? So that's very much Lovecrafty. You mentioned it before. Salem's Lot is, Dracula. Salem's Lot is just Dracula meets Peyton Place, for the most part.
Yes.
And Jerusalem's Lot, I know we don't want to go into a great synopsis, but I for people who haven't read it, it's a series of letters from a gentleman, Charles Boone, who has just moved into an ancestral home. And the people in the surrounding township of Preacher's Corners, they fear him. They say that anyone who lives in Chapelwaite, the name of the house, anyone who lives in Chapelwaite must either be mad or run the risk of becoming so. Right. So his whole family just has this history. And the story is him learning the history of his family and then ironically going insane. Sorry, not going insane, but seemingly going insane because he finds out it's all true.
Yes.
Which is fantastic. And it's got this, it kind of borders on cosmic horror, where Lovecraft has the Necronomicon, right? There's the book in Jerusalem's Lot is called De Vermis Mysterious. Or mysteries, I'm not sure how that's pronounced with the double I at the end. It's The Mystery of the Worm.
Yeah.
And the worm is like in my head, I don't know what you know about Lovecraft, but all I could see was a giant dole, which is a, you know, huge worm creature from his mythos. So it's very closely tied to Lovecraft. At one point, Charles refers to the church. He and his manservant, Calvin, they go to the nearby town of Jerusalem's Lot, which is all, you know, run down and basically just deserted.
Yeah,
and
they
find this church. They find this awful church, and he refers to it as a place where the milk of the cosmos has become sour and rancid. And I couldn't think of anything more Lovecraft than that.
I had a lot of Lovecraft running through my head while I was reading it. And as you mentioned with the rat, that reminded me of that story, which I haven't read for quite some time. But it just, I was in the back of my mind, it was there. And then I think when I was like the mysteries of the worm and this and that, I was, because I had watched, can't think of the title, the Ken Russell movie with the worm woman, the Lair of the Worm Woman or something. Oh,
Lair of the White Worm.
That's it. Yeah. I could not think of what it was called. And yeah, because that was more recent. I had visions of that movie with the mysteries of the worm.
Oh, no doubt.
For some reason. It was that movie in the really insane scenes as I'm reading bits of this. I'm like, okay, that's interesting.
This was another one where, and again, not unlike Salem's Lot, you know, Ben Mears comes to town and he's just not trusted by people, right? Yeah. Even though he was, I mean, he's from Salem's Lot. He's a local. He's a local boy. But he came back after so long and people just looking at him like, what? You know? Mm. And that's what you have here with Charles Boone. People just don't trust him based on his family connection.
Yeah.
So there are thematic ties between this and Salem's Lot. Quite a few. I loved about the story, and it's really just King's writing that I'm going to fawn over right now, but the characters that they reference in this. So Charles is writing letters to his friend Bones. He writes to his friend Richard now and again. Mm. But they mention people that they just drop names. We don't know these people. They have really nothing to do with the story. But he mentions Mr. Calhoun, our long-winded friend, Mr. Calhoun. He mentions Hansen in England on another of his confounded jaunts. And Mr. Clary, who held a fundraiser for the cause. No, we don't know any of these people. We don't know what the cause is. We don't know their cause. We don't know what Hansen is doing in England, except that he's consistently, you know, globetrotting. I love this stuff, this world building that he does with literally one sentence, right? Mm. It doesn't make you feel isolated, you know, like, who are these people and why are you talking about them? It actually brings you further into the world. Like, it makes you feel, it made me feel anyway, more comfortable with Charles Boone and listening to him and going, oh, okay, yeah, I get, you know, I know where you're coming from. I don't know who these people are, but you're speaking so casually about them. I feel like I know Boone a little better.
Mm. What I liked about this was, I guess, going into it and not knowing what it was at all, just kind of knowing the time frame it was set. And that the story is told with letters and diary entries.
Like,
so
that,
I actually really liked that because I wasn't expecting it. But then I really liked how we read what Charles Boone has been writing, and then at the same time, what Calvin has put into like his journal or diary.
Oh, his pocket.
And how different, like, they're describing the same kind of events, but you see it from those two different perspectives. And I really liked that because it makes you question, I guess, your narrator a lot.
Absolutely.
And it gets more, it just builds up over, I guess, over the pages, where it does culminate in this very big, just, well, okay, kind of ending, and then like this editor's note at the end, and I was like, well, damn. It's only, well, I think it's like 20-ish pages, but I'm like, I could have had 200 pages because I was quite intrigued by the whole
thing. It is. And what you mentioned there about Boone being an unreliable, sort of an unreliable narrator, he brings this up in the beginning. You know, he says something about perhaps suffering from the brain fever that took him when his when his wife died.
Yeah.
Right. So he sets it up that he's already had episodes.
Mm.
Right. So when we read Cal's journal, Calvin is saying that, oh, he fears that Mr. Boone has fallen back into the madness. So when they get to the church for the second time, this the worm, I guess, the big worm, sort of bursts out of the floor, right? Kills poor Calvin, right?
And
Cal, he was so good. And so he Boone is writing all of this to Bones, and the fella at the end, who is in present day, who has collected all of these letters because he now has inherited Chapelwaite, he's been back to Jerusalem's lot. The church is there, but the floorboard, everything's fine. There's no evidence of a gigantic worm having burst through anything. The place is deserted, he says, yes. But so that, again, makes you wonder, what was Charles Boone witnessing this, or was he insane, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, this new guy, he hears noises in the walls just as Charles did. So already, now you're like, oh, wait a minute. Is Charles...
Yeah.
Which, and we haven't mentioned this at all, the link with the Nosferatu. All the links, but the link here from Salem's Lot should be vampires. And that's, honest to God, the least interesting part of this story.
It is, actually.
Talk about the vampire connection. I'll let you do that. I've been going on forever.
You have. No. I kid. I am absolutely fascinated listening to you talk. So, yeah, just going back to that, like, end bit with the same, like, oh, the place needs the exterminator. There are huge rats in the walls. Like, I liked that whole thing. And it makes you question, like, oh, so maybe he wasn't insane? Maybe the place just makes you insane. But there was, I got to try and think back to the story. There was a whole thing where there was an encrypted diary.
Oh, yes.
Book thing. And Calvin, I think, deciphers it. And then they find the Nosferatu. I think it's hidden behind the walls in the cellar.
They go into the basement, and that's where his cousin hanged himself after his daughter had, you know, died in an accident on the stairs. And the chair is still there. When they go down, the chair and the rope are still there.
It's still there, yeah. Right?
And that's when the cousin and the daughter come out from behind the wall as the undead, yeah.
Yeah, that's one thing I guess I distinctly remember because one of the characters' name was Marcella, which is, you know, my name.
Yes.
If you pronounced it differently. meanwhile, but that's something that struck to me as kind of very Salem's Lot-ish with those undead kind of breaking through. So we know that there's some kind of undead force around. But I think, was there some kind of like witchcraft stuff thrown in there somewhere?
Well, that's the book.
Yeah.
You know? So less witchcraft and just occultish, you know?
Yeah.
But it was his, would it be his great-great-grandfather?
It was like a...
James Boone, or...
James Boone?
Who, he started the whole, he founded Jerusalem's Lot, he started this whole church, his brother, he got his brother Philip into it. Philip is the one who then found the book for them, right?
And there's the stuff with the book, yeah. My brain's all muddled, thing. But yeah.
And the whole town of Jerusalem's Lot was like inbred and horrible. In the end, at the church, Charles sees James, who had to be like 140 years old by this point.
Yeah.
He's still there. He's still living there. So it just continues, like the line continues. And that comes back, blood calling to blood, which is the, you know, the big Lovecraft connection there.
Yeah, because they have the Robert Diary, I think, where they learn all of this stuff with the inbred occult stuff. And I think there's something like a curse upon the place and stuff.
The
like
curse.
That.
The townspeople think of it as a curse.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot happens in 20 pages, and it's really interesting. Like it, and the way it's written, especially for me, going back to something that's, you know, more written to when it is set, it's like I got to reread passages to really take it in. And there's like so many interesting visuals, like the weird church with the obscene things that they see and inverted crosses. There's things like this that I remember, but then how it all ties in, it's like, wait, I got to read that again.
I'll tell you what, I used to have an audiobook collection of Night Shift and Skeleton Crew. It wasn't all of the stories. It was just, there were like five stories, five tapes in each one. So there's maybe, you know, 7 to 10 stories. And Jerusalem's Lot was one of them. But I listened to audiobooks when I go to sleep, like to this day. So from the time I was like 14 or so, I've been listening to audiobooks because the slightest noise in the house will wake me up and I not even let me get to sleep. But with an audiobook, my brain can sort of latch onto that and then I'm out and it's good, right? So I've been listening to these Stephen King audios for, you know, all 35 years, right? Mm. And Jerusalem's Lot was one that I listened to quite often, but I'd only hear the first 10 minutes.
And then you'd be asleep.
Right. So now I've read the story and I have listened to it, you know, top to bottom, but I haven't read it in so long that I did forget so much of what was happening because like I said, you know, I knew the beginning very well and I knew how it ended, but everything in the middle, there is just so much happening in here, so much going on. And I'll be completely honest with you. I forgot about the Nosferatu in the basement.
Yeah.
Totally forgot about him because I'm thinking about the giant worm and the abandoned church and the little town and everything. Yeah, totally forgot about the
because I was thinking like there are like there's a vampire thing in here somewhere, right? Right. And that's the thing I remember because I think the one of those in the basement was called Marcella. Mm-hmm, I'm assuming it would have been Marcella, and that's how I remember things because my name is never anywhere. But for someone who hadn't read this story up until obviously to prep for this podcast, and I went through it twice, and so much does happen that I've struggled to kind of put all the pieces together, and it's like, wait, did this happen then, or did that happen then? I don't quite remember. And then I'm like, wait, Chapelwaite's like the house, and remembering all the little bits and pieces. It's definitely something I kind of want to read again. Because it does give you those really interesting visuals and so much weird stuff happens and really feeling that Lovecraft connection as well.
Yeah.
Even though I haven't read Lovecraft for quite some time, it was still very much there and kind of noticeable. So it's very bizarre, but I liked it. And it's something I definitely recommend people who haven't read it or perhaps have seen Chapelwaite, the TV series, to go and actually read this short story. I don't know because I haven't seen it yet. We will cover that separately, but I have nothing to compare it to at the point of reading it. So
it's
absolutely fascinating, really fascinating.
Yeah, and this story is a good intro to Lovecraft. I mean, it's a great primer. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to jump right, I caution people not to jump right into Lovecraft because his writing's so dense. It's so dense. Mm. I actually think it was Stephen King who said that Lovecraft wasn't a great writer, but an incredible world builder. Right? Mm. Don't quote me quoting him on that. I think it was Stephen King. I can't be sure. But it's true. Lovecraft's the language he uses and the words he uses, sometimes you have to look some of this stuff up.
Yeah,
you
know? Right.
And so you don't want to dive right into Lovecraft. And this one, so Lovecraftian, you know, it's a nice little springboard. Like it gets you in there. Mm. And King's done that with, there's some other more themed episodes for us perhaps, but there's Crouch End is very Lovecrafty. His story N about the giant rock formations, very cosmic horror, that sort of thing. So yeah, I do. I love this story. This is one I kind of, my mind goes back to quite a bit. When I think of some of the best King, Jerusalem's Lot is right up there.
Yeah. And in doing, you know, a little bit of research and looking up certain things I could just find about Jerusalem's Lot, a few things have quoted as saying one of his best short stories. And having read it, like, damn, it is damn fine piece of literary fiction. Or is it fiction? Maybe he knows something we don't know.
He said one time of The Stand, like people come up to him and tell him, you know, that The Stand is their favorite book. And of course, The Stand is like 40 years old, right? So he doesn't feel great about that. He doesn't feel, you know, it's like, I have written some things in between. For something that he wrote in college to still be looked at as one of his greatest stories, I'm sure that's bittersweet as well. That's got to be very bittersweet.
You got to hand it to the guy writing something so good in college. Like, can I even write something that good now? Probably not. Who knows?
That son of a bitch. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
He made that deal with the devil before I could for that talent, damn it. All right, let's move on to One for the Road. Of course, it is another short story in Night Shift, and it is a story that is narrated in the first person by Booth, and he talks about events that take place during a snowstorm neighboring Jerusalem's Lot. And the events take place, I think, 1 or 2 years after what happened in Salem's Lot.
2 years, yeah. Yeah, they mentioned it's been, it burned out. 2 years ago, they said. Yeah.
So, again, this was one I hadn't read. I didn't really know what it was until you brought it up. So I looked it up and I'm like, okay, so it takes place after Salem's Lot. Let's do this. What a very different story this is.
Yeah. Yeah. And this one, a proper sequel. Like a completely proper sequel. It does mention Marston House, mentions certain specific areas, you know, that we know from the novel, from Salem's Lot. It's very different in tone as well, because like you mentioned, this one's narrated in first person by this guy Booth. And when we were talking about Jerusalem's Lot, I'm going back in my head now, being afraid that I've called Boone Booth a time or two because of the of the closeness of the
yeah. Even I was getting confused when I was reading One for the Road. I'm like, wait, this isn't the same guy. Oh, no, it says Booth.
It's Booth, right? So this is Booth talking about a night that he spent in the bar at Tukey's bar, his friend Herb Tuklander, where this guy just sort of bursts into the bar in the middle of the snowstorm. He had left his family in the car. They had gone off on a road that had not been plowed, and he walked the 6 miles, you know, back into town, and now he's asking for help. The beautiful thing about this story, and Marcy, you know I'm a structure monkey, like structure is my thing, so I'm looking at the structure of this, and you feel bad for this guy at first. You know, like, oh, my wife, my daughter, you know, oh, they're out in this. It's like, oh no. But he gets snippy with with Tukey. He just gets snippy with him, and you're like, oh, well, this guy. And Tukey already has a low opinion of this guy because he knows he's not a local. He figures he's from New York, right? Something.
Yeah.
Turns out to be from New Jersey. And Booth thinks to himself, the only thing worse than a fool from New York is a fool from New Jersey. Yeah. Yeah. So it that's great, because you don't care so much that this guy, about the fate that this guy meets in the end, because he kind of, you don't want to say he deserves it, but look, you know, he was kind of a jerk about these people offering him help.
He was, and it does kind of turn you against him a little bit, and then you totally understand the frustrations of Tukey and Booth, whereas you kind of thinking like, yeah, I might have just thrown him out. Go find your family and your car that's running out of gas. We know what goes on in these parts near Jerusalem's Lot.
and that's it. And they're being fairly cagey about it. So at the same time, this guy Lumley, his name is Gerard Lumley. So he, you know, when he bursts in and he's a little confused and he's, you know, but when he says 6 miles, they look at each other like they already know. Booth and Tukey, they already know. They're like, oh, did you say 6 miles? They know how far away Salem's are. They know what's going on here.
Yeah.
But they're not very forthcoming about it. Largely because how can you be forthcoming about a town that's infested with vampires?
Exactly. And we know that's what's happened.
So they're being cagey about it, and Lumley's getting annoyed with them.
He's getting shitty.
He is being quite snappish. But, you know, so they're like, okay, look, we'll go out. We'll get the, you know, we'll help you. Tukey says, all right, look, we'll hop in my truck. I've got a truck with, you know, and we'll go. And again, Lumley's like, well, why didn't you mention this? Why did we spend 10 minutes, you know, talking about this? And you really, yeah, like you said, it's like, all right, well, go find him yourself.
Yeah.
Go find him yourself. But what it does, like, it just gives it to us. It kind of drip feeds it to us. Like, if we don't know Salem's Lot, which that'd be a great sort of experiment control thing, I would say, but you know the movie, you know enough about the movie to be familiar, to get the references in this stuff. Like, someone who hasn't seen it, who hasn't read the book, doesn't know anything, the story still works on its own
I can see that too, because it's kind of contained, and whatever you need to know about what it's kind of alluding to, it's already kind of there, and you don't necessarily need that. And then when they kind of do go out in the snowstorm, like, while you know what they're gonna kind of see, it's more of a surprise probably if you don't know that it's like vampires.
He brings up vampires pretty early on. Booth does. He's like, well, I only heard the word vampires mentioned once, and that's when they give this backstory about Richie Messina a couple years previous. This guy Richie Messina, who again, and this is this world building that King does, he just mentions people Like, we're supposed to know who they are.
Mm.
The Richie Messina story, who was a truck driver, was quite drunk one night and said, look, you are all so afraid of Salem's Lot. I'll tell you what's up there. It's a pack of wild dogs. That's it, right? And he says, for $80, I'll go spend the night in Salem's Lot. And I'd love to know where King came up with $80, because that seems like a really specific sum of money. Like, I think Richie needed $80 to pay like a phone bill or something like that. Like, there's something bizarre about $80.
Yeah, you know, right?
$50, $100, great, cool. $80? For $80, he's going to go up there. And nobody in the bar is, you know, takes him up on it. But he goes anyway. So you're like, how bad did you need the $80, Richie? But he goes, he takes off. And Lamont Henry, again, just a name drop from out of nowhere. Lamont Henry says, that's the last time we're going to see Richie Messina. And it is. And it's this little vignette dropped in the middle of this short story is just fantastic. It's just a beautiful little thing. Because it's like a little story within a story about a story that we already know. It's like one of those Russian nesting dolls.
Yes. I'd almost forgotten there was that bit in there till you mentioned it, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's right. And that line where it's like, well, no one's gonna see him again.
Yeah.
And you're kind of sitting there going, yep, no shit, they're not. And you know, as this kind of can, like, you know, the third act of the story, where they're actually in the snowstorm, they're trying to find the car, and where's, you know, this guy's, Lumley's wife and daughter, but we kind of know what's probably happened to them. But it's the reveal of them as, I guess, the undead, as specifically the little girl, and how Booth sees that and how that ends up haunting him for so long. I think that's so well written, and I was not expecting that to kind of happen either. And I can imagine it would have been some kind of horrific sight that, you know, he recounts this and remembers it.
As vividly as he does too. And once they get there, they get to the car, and, you know, Lumley was worried that they were going to run out of gas because they had the heat going.
Yeah.
And it's still running. He throws the door open, but his wife and daughter are gone, right? So he goes running out into the snow, and he's looking for him, and Booth and Tukey run after him, but he finds his wife. And she, you know, she's a vampire. She's a vampire. She takes care of him. So Tukey and Booth run back to the truck, and that's where the little girl is. And Booth is ready to pick her up. He's ready. He's mesmerized. He's already half gone. When Tukey throws a fucking Bible at her.
He throws a fucking Bible to save the day.
He hooked a Bible at a little girl, which is an image that I can't get out of my head. And saves Booth and everything. But you're right. It does. It ends in a way that you don't expect it ending, which is not to say that there's no closure, but, and yes, it's an open-ended sort of thing because things are still happening in Salem's Lot. But the last line is so haunting about this little girl being out there still waiting for, you know, still waiting for her goodnight kiss.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, it's not, as you said, not quite what you expect.
No.
From this, you know, not quite the way you think this is going
to
go.
It's very haunting to just end like that. And you can kind of look at that as, you know, sort kind of like themes of missing people, when people go missing around like highways and whatnot, and things in that general area. You can look at it like that, and things about in that regard. That's kind of how I saw it, is like, you know, I guess people go missing, but you know, is there so much in, is it worth looking for people who are missing? If they met this weird end, do people just not care enough to look for missing people? This is what it was making me think about. And I think that's like the power of, I guess, the written word of Stephen King. I was not expecting to think about these things, but I was. I mean, I'm sitting here going, wow, I'm, like all these people who go missing, whether they wanted to or not, and who's going to find them? But also, if there is a place that you know is condemned, just don't go there. Don't go anywhere near there.
just stay away. You know,
see, well, a place he was Jerusalem's Lot. Don't go there. Salem's
he
Lot.
He was
don't
from New Jersey. He was from New Jersey. And they do bring this up. Like, Booth even brings this up about people who've just gone missing. You know, Richie Messina's wife figured that he moved to Florida.
Yeah.
You know, he just picked up and off to Florida, left her. And nobody really tugs too hard at that thread because of the specter of Salem's Lot. And they mentioned that, you know, that, yeah, people just went missing in Salem's Lot. They don't They don't go too deeply into that.
It's almost they're nonchalant about it.
Mm-hmm.
Which just really makes you think as well.
Which is even creepier.
Yeah. But just, yeah, if you see a place that looks like Salem's Lot or whichever, just don't go there. It's infested with vampires. They will haunt you or turn you or kill you or something.
I believe in Pet Sematary, when Rachel is coming back from Chicago, driving, going back to the house there in the third act, she passes a sign for Jerusalem's Lot and thinks about how beautiful and haunting a name that is, spend a night in Jerusalem's Lot. And she goes past, she doesn't take the exit, but it's drawing her in. Now, Rachel's got her own issues. Rachel's got her own problems to take care of at home. But it's that powerful that just driving past that sign sort of like, makes her want to take that left, take that turn. Yeah.
Although things may have worked out just as bad for her if she did take that turn. So.
Yeah, it really is six of one, half a dozen for the other for Rachel there, isn't it?
Oh, geez. But it's very interesting that, these two things that kind of focus, I guess, the central thing is like with Salem's Lot, but we're going back to something else. But then we go forward to something else. It's actually very interesting in how reading these back to back form a very interesting kind of story without having that kind of in-between thing.
Yeah.
And not really having read the in-between thing, that these still work really well with, not even as much context as maybe I needed to, but it still just plays out really well.
No, absolutely. You're absolutely right. One for the Road could be a sequel to Jerusalem's Lot. It could follow on from that. Absolutely. Mm. Without the novel, without the novel in between. There was in sort of researching this, someone questioned why Marston House and not Chapelwaite. Like, there was already this evil house in the Jerusalem's Lot short story. And this is why I said in the beginning of that discussion that I kind of feel that Salem's Lot is an alternate universe version of the Jerusalem's Lot story. It could have been this way, but it sort of went another way at a certain point. And that's why I said it was a springboard. But using, what you're saying, there's absolutely no... there's absolutely no saying that this place in One for the Road is not that Jerusalem's Lot. If you pull the novel out, anything could have gone on in the 100 or so years in between.
Yeah. I mean, what actually happened to Chapelwaite?
Yes. Yes. I like to think that Marston House was built on the
on the ruins. Maybe it just turned that way over time. There's like a loose kind of weird connection that's not written anywhere. It's just how we think of it. But I guess that's kind of what King may have done, is sprinkle those little seeds there that we, kind of join the dots ourselves.
And if you follow down that rabbit hole, you will find many people who have connected those dots.
Yeah.
In weird and fascinating ways.
there is a lot to connect in the Stephen King universe, because obviously some of the same characters show up, same locations, all sorts of things. Somehow everything's connected in one weird way in the weirdest alternate universe, the King.
And that's all gunslinger stuff. The different universes, all of that sort of stuff. So everything that we just discussed is quite possible in that in that universe. In it,
yeah. Yeah, it
really is. Just looking at these characters, I don't know if you've ever seen Castle Rock.
Not yet. It is on the list.
Look, I'll tell you what. Without spoilers, I was so disappointed in Castle Rock because of the characters they chose to use. But they used Alan Pangborn, which makes complete sense. They used Sheriff Alan Pangborn from Needful Things. But some characters, like there's a girl in the first season called Jackie Torrent, right? And her name's not even Jackie. She just took that because her uncle Jack. And I'm like, oh, fuck. What does The Shining have to do with Castle Rock? Like, nothing, right? And the second season is actually set in Jerusalem's Lot. I kind of vampires, but more or less, just resurrected dead sort of thing happening. But also they used Annie Wilkes to draw a really tenuous connection here. And I'm thinking, where are characters like Lamont Henry and Billy Larrabee? And, you know, where was Tookie's bar? You know, where was this stuff? Where was fucking in Mrs. Todd's Shortcut, which is another one that we've so got to do. I love Mrs. Todd's Shortcut. These two guys, like these sort of unknown characters from the short stories still inhabit this universe. And Castle Rock said, now we're going to do Misery. Like, fuck you guys. You know, it was so bad because going back and looking at these short stories, there's a whole universe of characters here that just goes completely unused and, you know, unappreciated. And that's what we were talking about before.
Yeah. And I think that's kind of, you know, part of this podcast is we'll be talking about, you know, very interesting different characters that don't often get mentioned or brought up in, you know, something like Castle Rock.
Yeah, certainly.
And, you know, I think, and it's a very different experience as well, reading to watching, obviously. And, you know, this gives us a chance to really just focus on the written word and actually really appreciate, you know, all these little things like Gerard Lumley being a bit of a dick, you know, a bit through the story, things like that. It's very, very interesting. I keep saying interesting, and it's not the word I want. It's intriguing, maybe. It's definitely, it's been a very interesting ride with these two short stories, and I'm very excited to dive into more in the near future when we continue on with the show.
I was going to say the same thing. I'm excited to see where we go with this, and also very excited for you to read Salem's Lot.
Yes, I will have to do that.
Please.
We will come back in a few months when I've read it, and we'll talk about the book.
Okay, very good. Very
good. We will throw the occasional book or novella in there somewhere, but we are going to focus more on the short stories. But yeah, I think I actually really enjoyed both Jerusalem's Lot and One for the Road. If I were to give them ratings out of 5, I would probably sit on a solid like 4.5 out of 5 for both, because I think they're that good.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I go 5 and 4. Five and four. I think they're great. And, you know, I can't fault Jerusalem's Lot at all. Not at all. And One for the Road it's just as good, but different. The same but different.
That's what I really liked about both of them. And yeah, thank you for pairing these together and coming up with, you know, what we're doing for our debut episode.
Oh, no worries. And see what else we can come up with.
We already have planned what we're going to do for episode 2, I believe.
Yes.
That's in the bag already. So tell our listeners what they can look forward to next.
We are going to be looking at actually what started the whole pairing off anyway was The Lawnmower Man and Weeds. Again, you might be familiar with Lawnmower Man from the movie that actually King took his name off.
Yeah.
Because it was so unconnected to his short story. And Weeds was filmed in Creepshow. It's the story that Stephen King starred in. Because according to him, he gives good idiot.
He's not wrong. He does. He's great as Geordie Verrill.
Geordie Verrill's wonderful. Wonderful. So, there it is. Lawnmower Man and Weeds.
Very, very excited for those two. We'll be back for episode 2, hopefully in a month or so. Yeah, we thank people for listening to us ramble about Stephen King, two short stories for this episode, but I found it very enjoyable. Hopefully I'll be able to get my words out better as I progress. I've been podcasting for 12 years. Half the time I don't know what I'm doing, but
you'll get it soon. It'll work out soon. It'll hit you. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And like I said, I can ramble about Stephen King for days on end. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm really having fun with this.
Yes, I'm very excited. And I think our first episode is really good. And everybody can check me out at the Super Network at supermarcy.com. And you can find all my socials in the show description or show notes. And if you want to contact me personally, I'm on Twitter at supermarcy.com and letterboxd at super_Marcy. And until next time, I'm avoiding Chapel Waite and Jerusalem's Lot and snowstorms in the middle of summer.
I think you'll be lucky with the snowstorms here in Oz.
Yeah. Hopefully no vampires. So catch you later, everybody.
Bye.